Succession number 20472, Reel 1.
Les Turnham, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
St Mary Abbott's Hospital, London.
Which part of London's there?
Kensington.
Which year was this?
1932.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in London?
No, my schooling was locally in a place called Hanworth in Middlesex.
So you spent the Second World War years in Hanworth?
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
Do you remember what your address was in the war years?
I do indeed. Would you like it?
Please.
44 Sunningdale Avenue, Hanworth, Middlesex.
Well, did you have much bombing in that area during the war?
Quite a bit, yes, because it's very close to an airfield where aircraft were repaired during the war. So we had bombing plus incendiary bombs and things like that, landmines.
Can you describe what you remember of the bombing, please?
Not really a lot as such, because it was mostly done at night. I mean, you sort of heard the bombs go off. But I never slept in a shelter, because they were surface shelters out in the road. And my mother always worked on the assumption that if something was going to hit, it would hit the shelter or the house. So let's sleep in a soft bed. So we just stayed in bed. But you heard the bombs go off, and the next morning in the field was craters.
Were you ever frightened during the war?
Well, I never remember being frightened. I think it was more excitement, really, with the children of my age, because she was collecting shrapnel and bits and pieces to exchange, or this foil that they used to drop. So I don't really think he was frightened. It was more he was out collecting, and like you do as a youngster, swapping bits and pieces.
What particular types of shrapnel or foil were you after?
Nothing in particular, it's just what was about. Empty incendiary cases and things like that. Anything that was, I suppose, really new and not what you was used to.
Was there any danger in it?
In hindsight, I suppose there could have been with the incendiary bombs. I mean, it was just a small 18-inch a bomb that you used to pick up. I mean, you never knew if it was still live or what, really. But saying that, I never knew of anybody being injured through picking these things up. So you must sort of assume that they was all expired.
And were there many troops or servicemen around in your area?
Oh, yes, plenty, because in the next, for want of a word, village, which was Feltham, was the army depot, which was an ordnance depot for troops. There was also Hounslow Barracks, which had troops in. That's about the only two I can think of. But there was probably more in the surrounding areas. And, of course, there was the airfield, but that was a repair base.
How did the troops behave themselves?
Well, as far as I know, all right, but then I was only, when the war started, I was, 7 years old, 8 years old.
Did the children have anything to do with the troops?
Not really, I don't think. I never recall of anything like that. It was sort of a daily routine of getting up and going to school and coming back home again. But saying that, of course, a lot of children in those days were latchkey children, because their parents, I mean, the men was in the services and a lot of the women was working in the ordnance depot, where they was packaging army equipment to be sent out abroad. So it was really a case of going to school dinners, because your mother obviously couldn't come home lunchtime, and again your latchkey when you finished school, and till your mother came home at night.
Did this type of life have any after effect on you?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. And I left school when I was 13.
What about prisoners of war? Did you get any of those in there?
Yes, there were prisoner of war in the area, which we used to see with the patches on. But they worked on farmland, really. I don't remember many of them, but there were certainly some about. I've got a feeling they was Italian.
Did you suffer any deprivations in the war?
No, I don't think so.
So rationing didn't affect you much?
It was just one of those things. It was, you had your ration for the week and everybody accepted it. I think it was a little bit like these days for identity cards. You had an identity card and you accepted it. You carried it the same as you carried a gas mask. You was at war and it was one of those things. You knew there was a shortage on food, but the amount we had always seemed to be adequate. So I don't think, no, we didn't suffer really. Probably a little inconvenient where, I mean, you look back in hindsight and you didn't get things which children now get, like bananas and oranges, which they now take as for granted. I mean, those sort of things we didn't have, but the basic food.
Any celebrations at the end of the war?
No. No, not that I remember. There must have been street parties somewhere, but the street that I lived in certainly didn't.
What happened to you on leaving school?
Well, I left school, as I said, before my 14th birthday, but that was due to the school system in being at that time. Drifted really into sort of lots of little jobs. And then I decided that it was a bit of I was in a bit of a dead end. And of course there was people coming back from the war saying how wonderful, well not what, how wonderful, the times they'd had where they'd been in the services. And I decided, or when I was 16, to ask my parents if I could go into the Navy, which they agreed to.
How did you go about it?
Well, obviously, I saw both of my parents that had to sign a consent form. And then I just applied to the recruiting office, which in those days was in Acton, Bromyard Avenue, Acton, and went for a written test. Then I had to go for a medical in Charing Cross Road, but I don't remember the address, which was things like colour blindness and all those sort of things. And then I waited to see if I was accepted, and I was on the 12th of July, 1949.
And the next step?
Off we went to, I was called up, and then we went to Corsham in Wiltshire, where I'd done my training, part one training, which is parade ground and getting kitted out and haircuts and all that sort of thing. Which we done 16 weeks training there, and then it was decided which branch you was to go into, or what was your choice, and then we were sent to the various training establishments from then after the 16 weeks when you passed out.
How did you cope with the basic training at Corsham?
I quite enjoyed it, really. It was a whole new world, in as much as you had much more rigid discipline. But you had three good meals a day, you had your uniform. In a company with a crowd of men, not that I'm anti-women, but it was all men together, a men's sort of sense of humour, which stayed throughout my service time. And no, I cope with it quite well. It wasn't a problem at all.
And was this base in Corsham called HMS something or other?
Yes, Royal Arthur, HMS Royal Arthur.
What were the terms on which you had signed on?
Well, the terms of agreement in those days was 7 years with the colours and 5 in reserve, or on reserve. But that took effect from your 18th birthday. So in actual fact, from 16 till I was 18, I actually gave the country time for nothing because it didn't count. Your time didn't count until your 18th birthday. Yes, it was just time I gave the country for nothing, really. But again, I didn't resent it. I knew what I'd signed up for, and I'd signed a contract. And there were longer terms of engagement, which I knew about. It was just that that suited me. I ended up doing over 8 years in the Navy, but only seven with the colours, as they say.
How were you treated at Corsham by the people in charge?
Well, as I said, the discipline was much stricter, obviously, than I'd had at home. And I suppose, in a way, it became a cultural shock to have a petty officer GI shout at you out the front. But the Navy was the Navy in those days. You joined it, and I just accepted it all the way along. I think majority of people did. There was the old one or two that couldn't accept the discipline and tried to go over the wire, as they say, in those days. Because when you joined the Navy, the first 3 days you were still actually a civilian. And so if anybody didn't like it, they gently eased you into it in those first 3 days. And after that, you walked in the hut one end, sort of strolled in, and you was marched out the other end with a pay book, and you was in. And you, in those days, you couldn't buy yourself out. You either had to get out on a medical if you were so inclined. Yes, there was no buying yourself out or anything in those days.
What's a GI?
Gunnery instructor.
And after Corsham?
From Corsham, I went, as they was then, stokers, but because I was, again, still underage, I was called a junior stoker. And we went to HMS Raleigh in Torpoint in Cornwall, which was a training ship for part two. It was all stokers. Again, I'm talking in 49. And it was all stokers where we'd had our part two training, which was learning about boilers and engines and things of that nature.
What were the main problems of doing a stoker's job in those days?
I don't really see there was problems. I always was interested in machinery, so again, that came quite easy to me. My training never ever bothered me at all. I mean, everybody has bad days. You have bad days in civilian life. You're thinking, what am I doing here? But other days, it was just fine. I enjoyed it. Enjoyed the company I was with. And I don't think there was any problem. I mean, it was schoolwork, obviously, then, as opposed to parade ground marching, because she was learning and you had to draw boilers and bits of machinery and things. It was schoolwork as opposed to marching. But there was sport every week. You always had sports, say boxing, cross-country, basketball, which I joined in. We was in the basketball team, the Navy basketball team, presumably because I was tall. But, I mean, we always had sport and things like that. And then after a period, we got leave, because you was only allowed leave at one time, sort of either a Saturday afternoon 1 week or a Sunday afternoon the next week. So you could go ashore and still see what the civilian population was doing. But, no, I spent right through till, beginning of 50 at training at Raleigh.
Any incidents that happened to you at HMS Raleigh?
Not really, except we was basketball champions. But that was probably nothing to do with me. I was just a member of the team. No, I don't think so. It was just a straightforward training routine.
And then?
And then I got posted to, funnily enough, Portsmouth, but I went to a rennery at a Wren's Barracks, because I was still a boy. And anybody over 18 went to the normal barracks, which was HMS Victory in those days. It's now HMS Nelson. But because we were boys, we were sent to the Rennery, and we had a block in the Wren's quarters where we used to go to the dockyard every day or work, but at night we slept in the Rennery, which was at Southsea, HMS Victoria. But I was only there about 3 weeks, and then I picked up my first seagoing ship.
How did it work out with these boys being in a Rennery?
They kept us apart, I think. They kept us apart. We had the end block.
Did they have any problems keeping you apart?
Not really, no. I mean, you're so busy occupied. I mean, we was doing firefighting courses, what they called ABCD courses, and various other courses. I think you really was whacked out in the end, but as I say, they more or less kept us apart.
Which ship did you go to?
Well, after 3 weeks at Southsea, I joined HMS Theseus, an aircraft carrier, light fleet carrier. And once again, my being a junior stoker raised a few questions. I wasn't the only one. There were several of us. And when we joined the ship, we was immediately sent to see the engineering commander, Commander E, a man called Commander Fenn Clark. And he looked at us and he said, "What are you?" And we said, "We're junior stokers." And he said, "What the hell's that?" So we said, "Well, actually, we are stokers, but we're really boys." Well, in those, again, going back to that time in the Navy, boys on ships were not allowed to work watches after 10 o'clock at night or before 6 in the morning. They wasn't allowed to. So the Commander E said, "You're going to muck my watch bill up completely if I get 10 stokers that I can't use through the night watches." So he said, "What I'll do is if you agree to do night watches, I will give you all night leave," which was an agreement we came to, and we all carried on as stokers, albeit we was boys, in fact, junior stokers.
So this was manipulating naval rules?
It was. We bent the rules a little way. But again, right through the ship, when we went on to the mess, our mess, which I was on 23 mess, when the rum ration came up, the leading stoker who drew the rum ration, he wouldn't have us on the mess. We had to be completely off the mess while he issued rum, in case we got too near it and spilt it or something, particularly his ration. But it worked well. Everybody accepted we should. I mean, and I'm the size I am now, I think, so nobody sort of look down at you or anything like that. You was a stoker and you was a stoker. I mean, and I then went on to do the normal things that a stoker does, which was boiler room watch keeping in the follow-up boiler room. I then, for a period when we eventually was going out to Korea later on, I was the damage control quartermaster, which we had stokers doing, strangely enough, which was a case of when the ship was fueling with aircraft fuel, which we had something like 97,000 gallons, there was no smoking throughout the ship at all because of the fire risk. And so we used to have quartermasters piping, "The ship is in a fuel danger state, no smoking throughout the ship," or "The ship is in a fuel venting state." We used to do watches like that. And then when we went to exercise action stations, you was in control of all the piping throughout the ship and any damage control reports. You used to do that. They all used to muster into damage control headquarters. So I had that job for some time. So a lot of people have heard my voice other than this tape, the people throughout the ship. But I got changed again I got we sort of moved around. You'd done so long in a particular job, and then you moved on again. And then by that time, we was due to go to Korea. And what it was, we spent the first part of 50 training round England as a normal carrier, and then the Korean War broke out. And the ship was fully trained up to a pitch. And when the Korean War came, I think one of the carriers was in Malta, the Glory or the Ocean, and the other one was out having a refit. And so Theseus was sent. We had our embarkation leave and went. But of course, one of the things, all the training they ever gave us, one of the things they couldn't forewarn us about was the cold that we was going to encounter when we got out to Korea, which is one of my abiding memories.
Can you tell me about the voyage to Korea, please?
Well, we started out, I was still 17 then. I think it was the 18th of August, about the 18th of August from Portsmouth. And on the journey out to Korea, the whole time we was exercising flying, aircraft landing on and taking off, doing rocket attacks on splash targets, things like that, while trying to maintain a straight line to get out to Korea. And that happened right the way through. We went from Spithead, Portsmouth, right through to Malta. But of course, just before we got to Malta, we were doing all these practices. And you've got to realise now, with an aircraft carrier in those days, that they only really had half the deck to land on, because you had barriers, and your deck park with your aircraft that had already landed was up on the forward end. There's no hovering aircraft like there are now, and of course also there was no helicopters. And just before we got to Malta, we had one of our aircraft come in, and it floated over the barriers and crashed into two aircraft in the front deck park. And one of the naval airmen that was working on the aircraft went over the side, and we never ever recovered him. He went over the side, and we had a funeral service when we got into Malta. There was an inquiry over it, but it was just an aircraft accident. And then we went to Malta, refueled in Aden, Indian Ocean, and made our way straight out there, really, as got as far as Hong Kong. And HMS Triumph was out there then. She was a sister ship that was actually on a Far East cruise, along with the Jamaica and several other ships. And she'd had a very brief period in Korea. Her aircraft really wasn't... There was good aircraft, but they wasn't ideal for the type of situation. They were Sea Fires, which was a Spitfire, a seagoing Spitfire, and Furies. And we took over from her and went then to Sasebo in Japan, which was the UN base, because the Americans were there as well. And we then proceeded up on our first patrol, which we was on the West Coast. We worked the West Coast. The United Nations, the British Commonwealth forces worked the West Coast, and the Americans worked the East Coast, with the exception for our last patrol, and we went to the East Coast as well. But we used to operate some little way off of shore, and by that time I was in the catapult crew on the aircraft carrier, which was consisted of firing the aircraft off. And then when they was off, those that didn't take off was pushed forward, and then I was on the barriers. We used to put the barriers up, waiting for the aircraft to come in.
Can you take me through, step by step, what those two jobs involved, please?
Well, what happened was, because you have to have so much wind over the deck to get an aircraft off, and the carrier has got to steam into wind to get lift, the added thing was that the armaments that the aircraft were carrying increased the aircraft weight, so we had to get at least about 28 knots over the deck straight into wind, which wasn't very good when it was winter. The aircraft were brought on, the man used to steer it from the tail, he had a long arm, and the aircraft was running forward, and he steered the back wheel and put it onto the catapult. The trolley came back with a wire strop on it, and I used to have to climb underneath the aircraft, under the bombs and the rockets, get hold of the strop, and it was fixed on the trolley of the catapult, and I used to hook it underneath the aircraft where there used to be a hook to hook it onto. It was then tensioned back, so it was tight, and then you used to get underneath again, lay on the flight deck. The engineer officer used to wave his flag, the pilot used to increase his revs to full throttle, and then the catapult man used to fire him off. But one of the tricks was, you always used to fire if the ship was pitching, you always used to fire when the pitch was down, so you had your nose in the sea. Because by the time the aircraft got to the end of the catapult, he was coming up again, so you fired him in the air. If you fired him when it was up that way, you fired him into the sea on the downward roll. So the aircraft used to come off. We used to keep firing off Sea Furies, Fireflies, whatever the strike was. And the strike used to go ashore, go to Korea to do bombing, rocketing, machine gunning, whatever they was doing. We used to have an anti-submarine cap, carrier air patrol, used to go round and round the carrier and the fleet, which was destroyers as well, all the time. The other aircraft was moved forward. We then used to run down, raise the barriers and the 10 wires that the aircraft used to have to catch when they come on, because they had a hook on the tail, and wait for the incoming flight, because you used to fire a strike off and your other strike was coming back, so you had to get rid of the first lot to get your second lot on. And then we used to catch them, and hopefully they never ever went into the barrier, because it used to shock load the engine. The engine was coming in at a speed, and if he didn't catch the wire, he used to go into the barrier and it used to stop the engine dead, and then we used to have to replace the barrier, lower the barriers, push the aircraft over the top, raise the barriers to pick up the next one. Later on, when we flew with the Americans on the East Coast, we only ever done one patrol with them, which was the USS Bataan. They never ever beat us on a landing. We landed an aircraft every between 12 and 15 seconds. And on a catapult, we fired aircraft off every 42 seconds. And the Yanks could only just keep up with us, bearing in mind they had two catapults. So then when the strike that had returned was all safely landed, the barriers went down, the aircraft were either went into the hangar for checks or whatever they had to do, and the strike was usually away just over a couple of hours. So in a couple of hours' time, you knew you had to repeat the process again.
Why could you do it so much faster than the Americans?
Because we was well trained. It was a split second. It was an automatic thing, you know, an automatic reaction. It was no doddering, what do I do now, or something like this. We'd had all this training on the way out, and we'd had the training and the crews prior to going to Korea, that everybody was all really on sort of top line.
Was it tiring work?
It was tiring because you was hauling these wire strops or barriers in physical type work, plus the machinery had to be maintained as well. Hydraulic leaks had to be always sort of checked, the nuts and bolts and things, and bailing out and things like that. But in the case of the winter, it was freezing work, and that was my thing in Korea, because we had no protection at all.
How were you dressed during the job?
Well, when we was out there, they issued us with really like a rubberized, for a want of a word, boiler suit. It wasn't warm in any way. The only thing is that it stopped the wind penetrating. And on our feet, we had rope-soled shoes and just a canvas helmet, identification helmet, on our head, which was a linen helmet.